This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Dr. Reverend William Coffin, Sloan Coffin. All right. Coming up in a moment, The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille and Roberta Maria Atti. It's 1 p.m. in New York City.
Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today, in our usual way, and thank you for being here, Roberta, we're looking at a different aspect of evolutionary psychology. A very couple of fascinating things have come up. This one around creativity. What makes man different than his animal brethren? His or her ability to be flexible is the answer. It's in the approach to solving any number of challenges, whether it be a social problem like how do you find a mate? You know, when it's not easily available, whether it's physical, how do you survive through the stresses of war, starvation, overpopulation, overpollution? Whatever the problem is, leave it to the humans, and they'll find an answer. I mean, animals have many answers. They could negotiate things, they could find things, they have their own ways of solving problems. But humans will actually copy the animals' way of doing things. For example, sonar. Right? You want to know how deep the ocean is? Use a trick that the whales use. Bounce a sound off the bottom of the water. You know, if you want to use if you want to fly away somewhere, if you want to see how far a distance is, you could figure it out. Humans created pyramids. How did they think of that? So if you've got a problem that needs solving, you could use animals. You could use if you want to know where water is, one tradition says go where there are cockroaches. Because cockroaches always nest where there's water. So you'll find a water source. If you want to be able to, or you could look for a cactus because you know there's going to be water nearby. If you want to find a truffle, you get a pig. Imagine how many different things we could do. Well, humans are not limited to any one particular thing.
Well, it seems that humans are, that they have a need to create, because, I mean, look at what has happened since humans have appeared on the face of the earth. They have actually usurped, I like that word, Armand, they have taken over, usurped.
Is that where the drug usurping comes from?
It must be.
Usurping.
Usurping, right. And they have taken over the creative momentum on Earth, so much so that everything on Earth now is in the hands of humans. So humans have the need to create something, whatever that might be, Ziploc bags, bicycles, cottage cheese, and radios, and whatever, they have to create. And ever since humans have appeared, we could say, Armand, that what has distinguished them from other primates and other animals is precisely their immense, infinite, endless creativity.
Today we want to take a look at the nature of creativity. Why? Why creativity? Is it really there? Is everybody creative? Are some people creative and others not? What's the difference between creativity and discipline? Is everybody in some way, are the people who are not creative suppressed? You know, repressed, depressed?
Well, creativity has been looked at as something in children, you know, children are playful and can be creative, or something that people who are not very serious about life engage in. And it's not something that's been encouraged in modern society, because often when people engage in creative activities, it is perceived that that activity is a waste of time, that it doesn't lead to anything productive unless you are an artist. But then those are few and far between, those who are recognized and then can sell their creative work and they can live off of it. So most of us are told, well, be creative when you have a chance, once a week on Sunday for 2 hours. But for the rest of the time, be productive, be serious.
Most
about
of
life.
It is seen as an indulgence.
Yes.
You know, you want to be a dancer. What do you want to be? I want to be a dancer. Right? That's one. Well, that's your indulgence.
That's a hobby.
That's a hobby. It's not a thing you do.
Right. You're not going to make
I want to be an
like
actor.
That.
I want to be a singer. Well, maybe you're possibly going to get successful, but be serious. Get a job.
Right.
Be an accountant.
It's considered that creativity is antithetical with productivity and with efficacy in life.
Yet.
I like the way you said that.
That's my Roberti yet. Yet.
Oh, that's nice.
We have become, yet we've been selected.
Right.
For creativity. And here's the fascinating information on a recent...
We've been fooled.
Recent bit of research by Gregory Feist, of all people, F-E-I-S-T, from the College of William and Mary.
Yeah, good old Gregory.
Greg Feist says...
Okay, so he says that creativity has been underestimated, underexplored, underanalyzed, misunderstood, under everything you can think of. Because in reality, creativity may very well be where it's at. Healing may be in creativity, salvation, saving the earth, whatever you can think of that's hopeful may be in creativity. Because think about it, every time life on earth, including human life, has been on the verge of extinction or has been in trouble, what has rescued it from the abyss has been some creative act, coming up with a pair of lungs, in the case of fish. When aquatic life could no longer live in the sea because it was overpopulated, creating a set of lungs was a creative act on the part of evolutionary forces. Now, humans, according to Dr. Feist, have been a species that has naturally and sexually been selective of creativity. And I think that we should distinguish, Armand, between natural and sexual selection, just so people know what we're talking about, and then we should explain what we mean when we say that creativity has been selected for.
Yeah, now this is an interesting perception. We think of the Darwinism?
Darwinism. By the way, there's an expo going on about... Charles Darwin at the, I believe, Metropolitan... at the Museum of Modern History.
Well, actually, they're starting it in the Bowery, and they're moving it up one block at a time. Darwinism is a belief in natural selection. Here's what we believe. We believe that a species survives because it is stronger than the other species.
Yes, natural selection is the competition among species, forms of life, for occupancy of a territory, basically.
So Brontosaurus rex, did you hear about the new dinosaurs they found down in South America?
No.
Ooh, this sounds like the opening of a joke, doesn't it?
It does.
Did you hear about the new... No, they actually found... a whole new group that went along with Tyrannosaurus rex that are even bigger than Tyrannosaurus rex. They found like 5 specimens.
Where?
South America, somewhere around Chile.
That big?
Yeah, giant.
What are they doing?
Well, that's the whole thing.
They're eating people?
No. I mean, these are bones.
Oh, well, yes, of course. Yeah, of course. They're going to keep finding them things all over the place.
But the idea here is that there was a competitor along at the same time as Tyrannosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes interesting. Who says, is the Brontosaurus going to make it or is Tyrannosaurus going to make it?
Mm-hmm.
Natural selection.
Natural selections, which means
the
one You go ahead, Armando.
The brontosaurus is big enough. He should be able to beat up everybody. You know, but
there may be something that the tyrannosaurus come
food.
Up with. There may be something an animal comes up with, like, you know, David and Goliath. There may be a flea that figures out a way to infect a large animal, and then the flea survives and the animal, large animal succumbs, because it's about who figures out how to outsmart their neighbors, basically.
That's it, and that's natural selection.
Yes.
Natural selection is Scarsdale.
What's Scarsdale?
Well, Scarsdale, living in Scarsdale.
Oh, I see.
Right. Natural selection is being able to get up on the food chain, you know?
Yes.
And now here he comes, that's when a species does that.
And that, by the way, has been going on the whole evolution, the whole time that things have, life has been evolving on Earth, because that happened way before humans. But in humans, natural selection has been going on, you know, for millions of years through the evolution of hominids, and it has been the major factor behind, let's say, the creation of hunting tools, or tools to carve and to make containers and wheels, and, you know, so the technical creativity that humans have been endowed with is part of natural selection.
And because humans had to compete with animals, and humans were smaller and didn't have ways of defending themselves, they had to become, in some way, come up with ways of beating out the other animals. This is part of natural selection. Then comes a thing called sexual selection,
which is much more recent.
Sexual selection
is
in humans, and it's a different thing.
Mm.
This is how within a species. Well, go ahead. You're doing
well. Okay, I said it's much more recent, but I kind of gave the punchline away there, because no, sexual selection has actually been going on hand in hand with natural selection all along in humans and in other species. But sexual selection occurs among individuals of the same species, whereby two similar individuals compete for mating, for whose genes are going to make it into the future, who is the best fit to propagate their genetic structure so that the species will continue to evolve and improve its ability to survive, versus who is not that fit and therefore kind of disappears into the past, into the background. So sexual selection has been going on hand in hand with natural selection. Natural selection among species.
So,
selection between individuals.
The hyena and the lion compete over the food.
That's natural selection.
Right? The lion, two lionesses compete over a lion.
Well, it's more likely two lions competing over a harem of lionesses in that case.
Two lions competing over lion eye, right? And lionum.
And Lionel.
Right. Yeah. And they get, but that's sexual selection.
That's sexual selection.
Now, what does that mean, sexual selection? It means I choose you for sex?
I choose to mate with you because I want to make sure that your genes are those who are going to make it into the future.
No, because I choose to mate with you because I got the hots for you.
that's
what the animal
line,
feels.
Yes.
But somewhere behind that, what's built into that is, and this way you're going to genetically select for the most superior.
Yes, we're designed to choose mates who somehow manifest traits that we consider valuable and important in survival, and those are things that are communicated not verbally, they're communicated through body size and posture and through scent and through hair length and through, you know, the way that we communicate sexual reproductive fitness is through body language and appearance.
And so if you like somebody, if you're somebody in your life right now that you feel attracted to, some level of you, whether you're having a baby with them or not, is saying you should be my co-baby maker. And mm-hmm. and between the two of us, I'm talking about even if it's a homosexual relationship, you're still saying you should be my co-baby maker. Mm-hmm. Some part of you is attracted to the other person, and you're selecting something inside you. This sexual selection is meant to produce a future for your species.
Yes, some researchers or maybe philosophers in this case go as far as saying that we think it's us choosing a mate, but it could very well be that it's the genetic structure within us, the DNA itself, that somehow makes us choose someone who has a genetic structure that works well with our own, and so it's actually the genes themselves that resonate with one another in such a way that we are attracted to that person. Isn't that amazing? So we
think it's
our mind, but it's really our.
It's like we're being run by our carburetor.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? We've got a little thing inside of us, our, you know, whatever runs the car, you know, whatever the starter, some little part of it. And we think, oh, we're the big car. But we're really the starter is calling the shot.
Yeah, we may be obeying the dictates of something that we're not even really aware of.
Well, you know, ever since
that we contain
the flower study, which is why how flowers got propagated in the first place, I've been humbled.
Absolutely. I'm with you, Armand. I'm humbled too. By the flowers.
But no, what about the flowers? Tell them.
What about the flowers?
Well, the idea.
Oh, the flowers, yes. The flowers, it turns out that they have figured out a way to give humans what humans like. The scent, the color, the beauty, the shape, the structure. There's something that flowers figured out that is so attractive for humans that humans are propagating flowers left and right by growing them and buying them and wanting them around. So the flower has actually been in control of that relationship much more so than the human, which is fascinating.
Which is fascinating because it's going to lead us to the whole idea of beauty
mm-hmm.
and what beauty is in natural selection, in sexual selection.
Right.
Now, just get this idea. The idea of the flowers is flowers would have never probably even existed. A little field of flowers is good enough. You don't have to be that colorful. You don't need all those colors. You don't need all those petals. You don't need to be able to live in a vase of water if you're a flower. Nobody ever thought of that. Hey, when I grow up, I want to be a flower that could live in a glass of water longer, you know, like a rose. Oh, I'll last a week as opposed to a poppy, you know. You know, no, there was none of that in nature.
Mm.
But flowers figured out that humans like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so flowers are now existing and happy all over the world,
yeah.
Booming.
Yeah.
Because they have us as their trained monkeys.
Yes, we are obedient to the flowers' demands.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Well, this whole idea of being at the demands of beauty brings in a concept of evolution which is very complex and very intriguing, and in the latest research.
It's intriguing, and it's also, at least for me, it gives me a lot of hope, because it tells us that there's a whole realm of the human psyche and the human experience that we have not yet even started to explore, let alone understand, and what goodies might be in there is left to be seen, and I'm very excited about it. Yes, there's a whole new branch of research that is now looking at creativity left and right to help us understand how to use it, what it is. Let's talk about what it is. What is creativity? Because this morning we were saying, well, there are creative individuals who don't really conclude much. They may be creative, but they don't have the wherewithal, let's say, to create anything. They just experience creativity internally, but they don't manifest it externally. So there's something we need to say immediately when it comes to creativity, that it's not that randomness, it's not that chaotic, all over the place creativity that we're talking about. It's creativity with discipline, creativity with structure that leads to the creation of something beautiful and useful, something novel and useful. So creativity leads to something that is recognized as novel and useful, not just by the individual who creates it, but by his or her peers as well. So that's the definition of creativity. Novel and
useful.
How
do you explain a pet rock?
Pet rock. A pet rock is a mixture, it's a combination of technological creativity and artistic creativity and clever marketing.
And how is it useful?
It's useful to the marketing people who made a lot of money off of it. It's useful because it gives people an experience that is pleasant in some way.
And that's it. And so if in some way something that's created drops your metabolism or makes you look at it or makes you feel mellow or gets you to release more serotonin or increases your dopamine, it's useful.
Sure. Even if you can't quantify it.
Useful does not mean you could use it as a hammer.
Okay, well, let's now distinguish between two kinds of creativity, which is the gist of this article that we're presenting to you. The author says there are two kinds of creativity that we can observe in humans. One is the technological creativity that has led to tool making and to creating things that were important for survival, that were useful, that were necessary in order to improve the quality of life. Not necessarily beautiful, not necessarily aesthetically pleasing, but certainly technologically useful. And that kind of creativity in humans started out millions of years ago and has been going on ever since. And it's the creativity that leads to the creation of this board that is in front of Armand. Armand has a board in front of him that allows him to engineer the program. And it's not pretty, but it's useful. You know, it has a lot of levers and buttons and lights that go on and off. It's useful. Now, but if I look at a work of art, you know, if I look at Michelangelo's work of art, it's very different. It's creative, but in a different way. Now, that kind of creativity does not go back that far in human history. It only goes back really about 60,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago at the most, where people started to paint the caves with images of animals. They started to sculpt figurines. They started to create beautiful things that were not necessarily useful. That kind of creativity is different from technological creativity. And that kind of creativity does not make any sense when you look at natural selection. Well, no, because it doesn't allow you to compete with your competitor species. But it does make sense in sexual selection, because apparently what has happened is that females, who are in charge of choosing genetic future of the species, have selected for males who could express beauty in some form or other, creatively, through art, through dance, through song, through painting, through sculpture. So creativity and artistic creativity has been selected for in the past 100,000 years, and now we're all affected by that choice So much so that all modern humans, Homo sapiens, sapiens, are inherently creative.
Now, this is very big stuff we're saying here. We're saying that, you know, one would make sense that it would be survival of the fittest. Well, you just give me the guy with the biggest muscles, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's it. Basically.
And that's all I need. Biggest muscles. He's going to go out, get the meat, bring it home.
I can just picture the guy with the big muscles carrying home a chunk of meat on his shoulder.
That's it. That's all you need him
is
for.
Is that
marry him and have
picture?
A baby. Meanwhile, you know, the women look around and they say, well, that's pretty good. But, you know, I think this is a dead end. There's a guy over there who's singing.
Mm-hmm.
Something about me likes the guy over there who's singing. Mm. Why do I like the guy who's singing? Because it means he has a mind that finds alternatives.
Right.
And I somehow, as an early hominid, decide it's not going to be good enough to just eat the same meat in the same cave over and over again. We're not going to survive that way. We're not going to survive because there's going to be other species coming in trying to get into our cave. We need flexibility. And the singer
mm-hmm.
has it. So I got to get some of his genes inside me. So while my husband's out hunting, I'm going to talk to the wedding singer.
Well, in fact, when this kind of creativity appeared in humans, not only did it emerge and appear, but it created this kind of creative explosion of art that now all of a sudden all humans became creative because sexual selection made it so. And what happened there was that because males realized that the more creative they were, the more they would attract females, they really invested themselves in this creative business, and their nervous systems started to grow and expand and change and develop in ways that had not been seen before and create connections and bridges and synapses in ways that were unthinkable before. And so now what you have is a creative explosion in terms of the artifacts and the things that people did, but also in the brain size and structure. You have a leap, which was a quantum leap in evolution for humans when this happened, whereby humans just really took a leap into intelligence that was astounding.
Through creativity.
Creativity, right.
Now, so... And then you all know about the time when the crooners came around and suddenly there were singers, you know, and suddenly everybody was singing, then poetry existed, then romantic stuff existed. All of this became part of the appeal. So whenever we think of survival of the fittest, when it comes to human, it's survival of beauty.
Yes.
And it is the essence, this is what they're discovering, and we can make a good case for it and give you references for it. But here's the thing, friends. You are born with a love of beauty, and you lose it. And it's possible it gets put away behind being practical.
Right.
And what happens to humans, and we're going to be talking about this much more after the break, is that humans have kind of lost touch with this intrinsic part of themselves.
Right.
It's in there. You all
it's
got
there.
It.
It's absolutely there.
Yep. And you can't, and so the best you could do is you can't eliminate it. You could pound a child's head and say, no, do your homework and do not be creative.
Mm.
But it's not going to do any good because it's going to leak out. Mm. It's going to get out somewhere from that child, or the child's going to go crazy or get depressed or, you know,
right.
Or get ADD.
Right. Right.
So you can't stamp it out of people, and in a funny way, we do it. We try to stamp out creativity in an effort to get people to be disciplined.
Yes, and productive.
And productive.
Right. And Armand and I are here to tell you that maybe we all have a treasure inside us that we have not yet discovered, but we're getting closer.
And this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti, here with you on The Positive Mind, WBAI. We're going to take a short break. I want to come back. I want to show you an interesting thing about music that I brought for you today. Just two pieces I want to play for you. I have two pieces of music that were both recorded on the same date by two people playing an instrument. And just thinking that I saw the recording dates and I was shocked. One is the Modern Jazz Quartet and the other is Glenn Gould. On the same day they were making this recording. So I want to play both pieces for you so you could hear a creative spirit on two almost opposite parts of the world in two different venues. And they're very brief, but I think you're going to love it as soon as we get back.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is the place to turn to.
Oh my God. And my mother got a sleeping suicide singing, oh my God. And my mother got a sleeping genocide singing, oh my God. And my mother got a sleeping suicide singing, oh my God. Oh my God.
Many different forms that the mind could take. What was fascinating with me with that was Glenn Gould's Goldberg Variations has got such intricacies, delicacies, interpretations of Bach that they're amazing. And then the Modern Jazz Quartet has their own interpretation. And you're saying, oh, this is not just interpretation. This is a mind at its freest.
Yes, it's a mind that where the innate biological forces are allowed to play themselves out naturally without anything hindering their natural flow, natural activity, natural tendencies. And this is what Armand and I are saying and what we're presenting to you today, that it's not true that only a section of the population is creative. Contrary to what some researchers have said in the past, it is really becoming apparent that Homo sapiens, us, everyone, is creative because creativity has been sexually selected for long enough that it's in all of us. And not only that, but creativity is a powerful reservoir of things that we don't know we have, like, for instance, self-comforting, self-reference, self-reliance, self-confidence, the capacity to to shift one's moods. I mean, there's a lot that we don't think we can do, and that we tap into creativity, and we might just find that our nervous systems know what to do because there is an innate inheritance there that we've been given by our ancestors that was selected for. In creativity, what happens with neurons is they naturally will tend to grow and form connections and bridges between different parts of the brain. So the different parts of your intelligence can connect to one another. I'll give an example. If you want to make a piece of jewelry, yes, you do need to have artistic creativity and a sense of beauty. But you also need to have a technical skill that requires discipline and structure and other resources of that nature in order to accomplish what you're trying to do. So in order to have both of these kinds of creativity joined together in that way to produce those results, you have to create bridges, neuronal extensions then go from one side of the brain to the other, left and right hemisphere. That makes your brain a very, very flexible and a very eclectic and a very capable structure that we have not even began to tap into.
Marilyn Ferguson, back in the late 80s, had a meeting, author of The Aquarian Conspiracy, and during this time she invited all the top scientists to her home. And I remember this meeting, and I went there delivering pizza. But I was,
what kind of pizza?
It was just, I was humbled by the level of people that were there. But what she had made up for everybody was sweatshirts. And the sweatshirts had MSU written on it. And MSU men make stuff up. And according to Marilyn's idea, she said, talent is cheap, but creativity, making stuff up, that's what the world is about. This is what we have to do. If we're going to save the planet, we have to make stuff up. Let's not repeat. Now, unfortunately, somebody goes for a job nowadays, and they go somewhere for a job, and the boss says, I want this done this way, this way, this way, and this way. And a person says, okay, that's the job I've got to do. I've got to do A, B, C, and D. And they feel this urging to get outside the box, which is natural because there's a creative urge, something that wants to do it differently.
Which is biological.
Yes.
It's not a whim.
Right. It's not that you're just afraid to do a job.
No, your
brain
wants to.
It's like every part of you says you must do something a little creative and different here.
It's a need.
If the boss is knowledgeable, he lets room for that. But if he gets in his way, if he finds somebody who can't line up the ducks and he needs that done, you know, he can't hire you as his accountant. But if he needs that done, if he gives you the flexibility, you could grow into the job and find the job very appealing. But when you don't, it means that somewhere else in your life you have to be able to put that to work. Those of you who are chefs, cooks, you can cook by recipe, which is a creative thing all on its own, and you could cook by recipe with intention and recipe with creativity. Talk about the pieces of creativity. What do you need? You need imagination, right?
Okay, well, you cannot create anything that you cannot first imagine. You know, in order to create something, you first have to imagine it. And we were thinking before the program, Armand and I, we were thinking, well, how do we explain that? Well, imagine being a hominid sitting on the beach and nothing exists yet. And you're there and you look at the sea and you're not content to catch the fish that's right there by the shore and to just pick the clams out of the shells and eat them right there. And then you're looking at the ocean and you're thinking, what's on the other side of that? Or, I see something there. There's a piece of land there far at the horizon. What is it? What's on that land? I gotta go there. So you start thinking, well, how do I get there? And there your imagination needs to help you because there's no way that you could swim there. How are you gonna do it? Okay, so you see a piece of wood floating. Now you're starting to think, gee, if I can hold on to that piece of wood, maybe I can push myself to that island without drowning. And from there, you develop a transatlantic, a transoceanic ship that, you know, takes you across the ocean. So you have to imagine it first. And so, let me just say this, Armand, right here and now, because we're making the point, if there is something in your life that you wish for, why not imagine it? Even if it's not possible at the moment. Well, that's how someone figured out how to fly or how to create a bicycle. Okay, imagination. First step, imagine it first. Next step, we have to have the intention and the willingness to invest resources in our experimentation. And that's costly. That's the costly part.
I mean, I want to mention that many people will imagine an improvement in somebody else. They'll imagine, you know what
funny,
I mean?
Yes. I wish my husband were more organized.
Right. I wish my husband were more organized. So now my imagination, my creative imagination.
That's
says,
a waste of imagination.
Well, it's not actually, because then you have time, dedication, and willingness. And that means what you have to be able to do if you choose to do it. And it's almost like a codependent thing that you eventually get into. You say, I want to change my mate. And the way I'm going to change my mate is to give up my life and dedicate it to making it nice for my mate to change. This is a creative dead end.
Yes, it is, because there isn't really any way to change anyone from the outside in.
So if you consider making a change or imagining some improvement or something you would love, think about it as if you're the one doing it.
Right. It is has to be something that pertains to you and to what you want and hope for, not something you want for someone else. Absolutely.
So this step one is imagine what you would like.
Imagine what you would like. Like, can I imagine myself perfectly happy and peaceful and content? Can I imagine myself? When I ask this question, believe it or not, I don't know about you, Armand, with your work, but when I ask people, can you imagine yourself happy? People say no. So then my next thing that I ask is, well, if you can't even imagine it, how are you going to get there? Right? The first thing is created in your imagination, then investing. This is the costly part because...
Well, wait, let's take it down to a simpler thing than emotions, okay?
Sure.
Because I could see depressed people cannot imagine happiness because they can't. They can't feel it.
Well, but that's the trick of creativity, though.
But I'm not sure. If you say, let's create a piece of art, okay, let's go that way. Imagine I want to make a painting. Right. So now I've got something simple. I want to make a painting, and I want to feel that the painting represents me. I can't see it. What you're saying is you have to visualize it, but I could visualize a painting taking place.
It doesn't have to be a complete image of it. It begins in incremental steps. It can start with the beginning. I can imagine the first step in that.
I can imagine buying a canvas and putting it on an easel.
I imagine going to the art store and buying crayons and buying paper, and I can imagine myself sitting in the park in the sunshine and beauty of the springtime, drawing on a piece of paper.
Beautiful.
That's imagination.
Now, second step is, and when you have that imagination, you must then look at what Roberta says, time, dedication, and willingness.
There's an investment that is required where where we actually go do it, where we actually try to figure out how to accomplish this goal that we've set for ourselves, and we find the means and ways to get there. And if we want to build a ship, we got to find some wood, and we have to cut it, and we have to shape it, and we have to nail it together in such a way that we create a raft or something like that.
So, and be willing to deal with the
requires,
splinters and the time it takes.
Right, that's the investment part.
Okay, so I want to slow this down a second. Let's stick with the painting, okay, before we go to ships.
Okay.
I want to stick with the painting for a moment. Now you want to sit in the park. I love your image. Sitting in Central Park, sitting somewhere and just deciding you're doing a painting. Now comes this time, dedication, and willingness. Now, here's the problem. The problem is, with everything you do that requires a little dedicated time, you take a little dedicated time away from something that you're more familiar doing. So, for example, does that mean you will not watch American Idol that day? You will not watch television for that hour. You will not watch the cooking show. If you're going to give, if you're going to make the dedication, it has to feel like, okay, it's got to be okay that a couple of other things that I prefer to do, like sleep late, I don't do.
Or like stay in bed and cry.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, that could be a choice. Well, because it could be a choice for a person. I could choose to do something I'm familiar with.
Well, I'm trying to make it that sometimes you have to choose.
I know, I'm making it extreme, but I just want to, you know, really say something here.
I hear you. But now I'm trying to get you to choose between two good things.
Yes.
You see, and here it is in life. You could say there's something I want, and there's something I have to give up. I want to lose weight. I got to give up food. It's going to be a little less comfortable. So the time, the dedication, the willingness, and the forethought to say, it's okay to give up something, to get what I want. Okay? To start with that. Just start with that. It's okay if I want to go somewhere. If I want to paint in Central Park, it's going to be okay not to go rushing home and watching TV. Which I love to do, too. So I'm not going to do those. So that willingness and making peace on the inside, that it's not a big sacrifice, but it feels like a choice. That takes you partially in the direction. Next comes another thing, which is you have to invest resources. Now, this is not an easy thing.
Well, in my experience and observation, when I set out to do something creative that costs me in terms of deprivation and disappointment in losing something, that's not a good motivator. But if the motivation I set for myself is pleasure, meaning what do I get out of sitting in the park, drawing, painting something and doing something I've never done before. Oh, I get to feel adventurous. I get to be excited. I get to meet people. I get to talk to people. I get to those incentives that are the pleasurable ones may actually give me a stronger motivation than to deprive myself of a TV show or something that I like doing at that time. But the investment of resources is necessary because nothing creative can come about without us being willing to invest really our life into it, meaning the time that we have.
This time is one of the resources.
Time is the precious resource, the
money.
Most important resource. Money, it could be,
You could be investing your Well, again, but it goes back to time.
Well, let's say that I want to create something that I've never done before, and therefore I don't know whether it's going to succeed or not the first time I do it. I have to be willing to fail. That's a big investment because failure is something that people can't stand. They can't stand to do something that it's not going to work. Okay, so there's an investment in terms of that I have to be able to accept the fact that maybe it won't come out right the first time. And maybe I'm going to have to spend some time reading a little instruction book. Or maybe I'm going to have to spend time doing something I don't necessarily enjoy doing, like sharpening the pencils. Or maybe the ground at the park is going to be wet that day and I'm going to be uncomfortable and, you know, I'm going to have to do it the next day. So things like that, some kind of discomfort may come our way in the creative endeavor, but it should not deter us. It should not become a deterrent from persevering, because eventually what happens is with persistence we come to the other side. We reach the island that we were looking at. We build the ship. We paint the work of art. We get to be good at doing what we chose to do. We create something.
If you're lucky.
If exactly. Then there's an element of luck. Yes. Then there's an element of luck which says, if what I create is perhaps not a perfect thing and not appreciated by other people and not spectacular, can I still appreciate that by engaging in this creative endeavor, I am teaching my nervous system, or not teaching, I am allowing my nervous system to engage in an activity that it may benefit from regardless of the outcome?
May is even a light word. It did benefit by. Every person who's ever written a book, a screenplay, who's gone for an audition, who's practiced a part, who's tried to invent something, who's put the time and effort into it, has grown their brains.
Yes.
That's it. You got better brain growth, and now for you and all your future generations, it's a couple of extra ounces of gray matter.
But it's not just gray matter. It's that this gray matter allows the brain to do what the brain has been designed to do physiologically, which is to grow. Do you know, Armand, that it turns out that the brain is designed to continue to grow throughout life? It never, we were told that it stops at 20 years of age. It doesn't stop. It is designed to continue to grow all our lives from A to Z. And when it stops growing is when we start to not feel so good. And so by definition, when we don't feel so good, maybe allowing the brain to grow could offer some relief that we didn't think of.
One interesting theory about headache and migraine has been that it's a stunted growth pattern, that you'll find very, very creative people who suddenly stop being creative.
Right.
Right, and there's a pressure inside the head to fill this capacity.
That's for also a theory for depression.
Yeah.
That depression could be that if a child has a brain or a nervous system that is designed, that wants to grow in a certain way, and for whatever reason that's not possible, the brain and the neurons cannot grow naturally, so they have to limit themselves, to contain themselves, to cut themselves off in a way, and the symptom experienced by the child eventually becomes depression. So what could help that person? And I'm saying that it may, that it could, because sometimes there are other things that interfere with a person's willingness. Is to allow oneself to engage in creativity without worrying about the outcome, without expecting to be a master at something the first time we sit down and try it. I don't know. I don't want to sound like I'm preaching anything here, but I'm very excited about this material, Armand, because I find that there's so much hope in it, and in a way that we've not yet explored.
Well, we're going to go much further with this. The concept of sexual selection versus natural selection, and how the basis of sexual selection is being discovered is the appreciation of beauty, and that beauty is at the essence of the human condition. This being discovered by, what are they calling the new archaeologists?
The cognitive archaeologists.
The cognitive archaeologists who are putting the pieces together about the human mind. It's exciting stuff, my friends. It helps us take a look at our basics.
Yes.
And this is part of our basics. So this is Roberta Maria Atti, by the way, who's responsible for this research today and brought this to me, and I'm excited about what we're going to go with it. And Roberta can be, it's Creative Health Solutions.
.org.
Of all things, yeah. Creative Health Solutions, which is what you do.
Right. It is really my intention to promote creativity as the one thing we've not yet even looked at in the healing professions enough to, it's really, to me, where a lot of the answers that we're looking for, where they might just be.
And you could always contact me at thepositivemind.com. Look at the website. New website up there. We're now connecting some friends. It's fun. Now, here's something that I discovered from a while back, which I thought I would bring to you as we weave our way out of here. Called How to Be an Artist. Stay loose. Learn to watch snails. Make little steps that say yes, little signs that say yes, and put them all over your house. cry during movies, look forward to dreams, cultivate moods, refuse to just be responsible, believe in people, laugh a lot, take moon baths, have wild imaginings, transformative dreams, and draw on the walls. Read every day. Imagine yourself doing magic. Giggle with children. Listen to old people. Bless yourself. Play with everything. Entertain your outer child. Believe in your own innocence. Build a fort with blankets. Make up words. Dance with pillows. Get wet. Hug trees. Make funny faces in the mirror at least once a day. And when you're served a dinner, don't eat it until you breathe in the beauty of all that went into the food getting to you and the creativity that it took to have that meal get to you. Think of the cook, think of the server, think of the plate maker. Write a love letter. This is Armand DeMille.
Wednesday, April 19th, come attend a forum focusing on solutions to the genocide in Darfur. Participants will include New York Times op-ed columnist Nicholas Kristof, Mark Mullock Brown, UN Deputy Secretary General, Juan Mendez, UN Special Advisor on Prevention of Genocide, and Darfur refugee and activist Traji Mustafa. It takes place Wednesday, April 19th at 7 p.m. at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, located at 2 West 64th Street near Central Park West in Manhattan. Doors open at 6 p.m. for registration, and this event is free. For more information, call 212-874-5210. That's 212-874-5210, or go online at www.nysec.org.
Please join us at the WBAI Producer Series Homeland Insecurities for an interactive program centering on issues of civil liberties and government abuses of power. On the Count host, Annie Ellis, who spent 25 years in prison, will moderate a panel discussion about the prison industrial complex and the national security police state, and connect the political and economic role of prisons to crime, terrorism, national security, and civil liberties, with activist attorney Michael Tarif Warren, prison policy analyst Deborah Small, and Bill Goodman of the Center for Constitutional Rights. The event will be held Friday, April 21st, 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the CUNY Graduate Center, 315 Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. To register or for more information, call 212-815-8215. That's 212-815-8215.
The Lutheran Social Services Refugee Preventive Health Program is offering assistance in obtaining free health screenings for newly arrived refugees, asylees, victims of trafficking, Haitian and Cuban entrants, and Cuban parolees. These groups can receive referrals, information, and assistance on obtaining medical, mental health, and dental services. The Lutheran Social Services Refugee Preventive Health Program also provides community workshops on medical topics and resources. For information and assistance, contact 212-870-1167 or 212-870-1158. That's 212-870-1167 or 212-870-1158.
We now go to Christmas Coup Network News.
The next governor
of the great state of New York, Malachi McCord.
I thought I didn't need any introduction, but how do you do?
On Sunday, April 30th at 6 p.m., join WBAI host Malachi McCord, singer-songwriters Jay Mankita and Patricia Shee, and the Christmas Coup Comedy Players at a fundraiser to pay for this year's BAI coverage of the Clearwater Festival at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, Long Island. For information, call 631-423-7611 or go to www.clearwater.org.
Thank you very much. I'll be off now.
A panic.
Attention all WBAI listeners. WBAI is now archiving its programming. This means that any program that you're interested in or that you didn't get a chance to hear is now available for downloading on the internet. All you have to do is put www.archive.wbai.org in your search engine and follow the instructions. Just another way to enjoy and to share WBAI's programming. Again, the site is www.archive.wbai.org.
This is WBAI New York. Stay tuned for the Christmas Coup Comedy Players, a.k.a. the CCCP. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.